Okay, this is side two of session 31, recorded on March 5th, 2007. And just to finish the thought in the end of side one, I would say that I was trying to say that you can look at different cultures and their sensory biases, if you accept McLuhan's sensory profile terms, and you can see a flip-flopping of all these different cultures all over the world. The big pattern that McLuhan used from Finnegan's Wake was that, in general, all the cultures of the West became fascinated with the East, and all the cultures of the East became fascinated with the West. So he said that the best way you can get an education about Western culture is to declare war on the West, and then all the armaments brought in to defeat your move towards communism or whatever floods your culture with the Western tanks and hardware. So it's called the mouse that roared syndrome. There was a movie made with that title, maybe 61, 62, with Peter Sellers, and I think it was an interpretation of Castro ending up having a problem in the United States. So the general third world syndrome of pretending to go communist so you can get yourself declared war on, you're the mouse that roared, and therefore you can get all this Western technology. So there's a kind of panic, but an early obsession with getting the Western technology to protect yourself from the satellite tactility that's threatening every culture. So the cultural profiles of France, oral culture, they're oral literate. I mean, they are literate and industrial, but they have an oral, multisensuous bias more than the British stiff upper lip, not so multisensuous bias. So the French go hyper-visual and start thinking mighty, mighty penetrating probes about the effect of the new American technology on France. That may be the reason why they produced this kind of thought that became the content for the panicking in academic institutions in the West, whose very humanities, English, history, and social sciences were in a crisis because the high-tech revolution in the 80s was moving kids out of even concerned about the book values of English and history and anthropology, and everybody wanted to get a business degree, or at least learn stuff about computers. Mm-hmm. So the humanity departments needed some new intellectual abstract left hemisphere pattern recognition, and they got it from the French postmodernists. Mm-hmm. So they needed books. No longer was it a chemical body's existential drama. They need to keep their particular institution going. And the old books weren't making it anymore. So the next paragraph sums up some of the different aspects of these different writers, postmodern writers. So do we need to read? I read through this second paragraph.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I read, did I finish the first one when I was reading through it?
Yeah, I don't recall.
I'm just going to read, just in case I didn't. Well, let me just read these two paragraphs.
Okay.
Because what we're talking about, this is the core seeds, right in these two paragraphs. We're going to be seeing Coker develop these themes, but it's always coming back to these same patterns. So what is the pattern? Well, the postmodern scene is a panic book, because the postmodern scene is a panic quantum culture. And just beginning... Okay, I'll just continue. Indeed, the text itself should be read as imminently postmodern. Thus, for example, while Adorno and Horkheimer's Dialectic of Enlightenment was written in response to the outbreak of the fascist mind, the postmodern scene is written in response to the outbreak again of the Dialectic of Enlightenment. Now, when Croker, it just occurred to me, when Croker's saying that his book is postmodern, he's no longer worried about becoming what he behold or what he beheld. McLuhan would try to be anti-environmental. In the chip era, in the Croker's era, you can't be environmental anymore. In fact, it's just to pretend you're participating is an art form.
You can't be environmental or anti-environmental, you're saying.
Beg your pardon?
You can't be environmental or anti-environmental. You can't be you can't be seduced and hypnotized by the environment. You can't take a stance in opposition to it.
Yeah. In an age where computers reify the meaning of memory and panic sex is the language of the postmodern body, then it may still be salutary or healthy to meditate anew on historical remembrance as the basis of politics. And even my use of the word healthy for salutary may be questioned. Anyways, so it might be better said, then it may still be beneficial, profitable, to meditate anew on historical remembrance as the basis of politics. The postmodern scene, the book, while thriving in the detrital scenes of cultural amnesia, is also a market of remembrance. Decay, ecstasy, hyper-pessimism, hyper-optimism, memory amnesia. These are the double signs under which this text has been written. If this sounds paradoxical, ambivalent, and contradictory, this just means that, like the quantum age, which it seeks to describe, the postmodern scene is a quantum, that is to say, postmodern sign of its times. It's the very problem of trying to describe your time, and you mirror the time, become the time, is a service, or a flaw you can't overcome, so you wallow in it, which is like pushing to excess. The very flaw that the critic has. You know, make yourself even more flaw-filled, just like the excess waste and disaccumulation around you. You have to understand that people aren't accumulating things. You accumulate access to speed of communication, what Baudrillard later called the ecstasy of communication. And communication is interacting with all this computer landscape.
And when we were reading, finishing up Thompson, wasn't he said something about grasping it and then letting it go is, you know, really fast? You gotta snatch it and drop it as fast as you can.
That's right. No, it's very good you bring that up, because Thompson romanticizes that. He says that's what the real artist does. The knowledgeable intellectual or critic or whatever you're trying to be as an advocate of pattern recognition. He says you treat in a paragraph what you know could take up a whole academic monograph, but jugglers are too restless for that. The object of the game is to grasp the object quickly and then give it up in a flash to the brighter air. That is now what your average criminal executive is doing. You know, Milken and those guys who create the junk bonds. They're disaccumulating, grabbing, and letting it go rapidly. So in that sense, there's a big gap between the 80s mentality that Coker is discussing and the Thompson 70s strategies. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you know, what Thompson is advocating, the Andromine or the chips landscape is doing that, is letting grabbing and letting go as fast as possible. So he says, let's read the next paragraph where Coker develops that syndrome. For who can now speak with confidence of the future of a postmodern scene? You're not worried about the future when what is truly fascinating is the thrill of catastrophe. You're not trying to create a future that protects yourself from catastrophe. You're enjoying catastrophe because you see so much grabbing and letting go of whole economies and whole cultures and whole institutions. Bankruptcy everywhere. And where what drives, he's describing the postmodern scene, and where what drives onward economy, politics, culture, sex, and even eating is not the will to accumulation. There goes Marx's critique of the bourgeois just hogging private property. Even the bourgeois, the petty bourgeoisie, aren't into accumulating anything. They're just into moving through hypermobility all the discarnate media. But just and even eating is not the drive onward is not the will to accumulation or the search for lost coherences, but just the opposite, the ecstatic implosion of postmodern culture into excess, waste, and disaccumulation. When technology of the quantum order produces human beings who are part metal and part flesh, when robo-beings constitute the growing majority of a Western culture which fulfills, then exceeds, Weber's grim prophecy of the coming age of specialists without spirit, and when chip technology finally makes possible the fateful fusion of molecular biology and technique, there's the fusion that Coker is doing in his trying to mime the panic postmodern scene. He's fused with the mood of the times because the technology around has created a fateful fusion of molecular biology and technique. When that's the situation, then ours is genuinely a postmodern condition marked by the deepest, most pathological symptoms of nihilism. So in a way, Coker is putting on nihilism. he's trying to out-nihilist the postmodern environment. Not by his exaggerated, maybe, forms of pattern recognition. And we'll see that later in his writings. Not just science as the will to power, but also medicine as an empty will to knowledge of the lacerated body. Penology is a grisly will to surveillance of the body politic, and ethics itself is enucleated within the dynamic language of instrumental activism. The postmodern scene is therefore a catastrophe theory for a hyper-modern culture and society which is imploding, that means many catastrophes, which is imploding into the seductive simulacrum, which is imploding into the seductive simulacra of its own dark and negative sign. It's enjoying its own catastrophe, right?
Yeah.
Well, the future is a positive image.
Right.
There's no time for the future. So now you enjoy the catastrophe of the present.
Right.
Dark and negative sign.
Not having really studied nihilism too much, I'm starting to look into it a little bit, but just my intuition is that nihilist philosophy would inevitably lead to, if you take it to its conclusion, to a kind of a suicidal despair. Nothing has any meaning or reason for being any longer. It seems like Croker's going past that into a kind of a bipolar, ecstatic flip-flopping of despair and reckless ecstasy or something.
Yeah, not getting trapped in despair or optimism. He's enjoying the nihilism. He's like turning nihilism into a purposeless activity. So the ideology of nihilism in the 19th century was considered purposeless, and they wanted to topple the capitalists or social norms. But when the environment itself in the 80s becomes nihilistic, what are you going to do? You know, everything's disappeared. Now it's hyper reappearance and then disappearance and then return of reappearance. The nihilistic environment, you probe it by being more nihilistic than the environment can be. That's what Croker...
Turn nihilism into art form.
Yeah. And you do it in your media. You're not necessarily nihilistic personally with your chemical body.
Mm-hmm.
You're watching other people.
You're putting it on.
Yeah, but yeah, you're putting on the meme of the environmental causes. Whereas those that are trapped in that, their chemical body is the thing that's experiencing panic sex, panic medicine, panic noise. Think of the punk mosh pit. So Croker, there is a level of detachment here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the book would be panic because there's no ground for it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. He's saying, let's try to keep the book meme going. We'll just quickly write a book claiming everything is in a desperate state. And we'll admit that we're part of that.
Right.
And our form of writing is, our style of writing is that.
Yeah, so we'll the book see. Just becomes another expression of that. It's not the...
Yeah, it's more excess. He says, we create these publishers, New World Perspectives is called, as an act of panic, engagement with the postmodern panic.
Right.
Now, we're going to see what I just read, that big chunk. You're going to see these themes repeated and developed. So let's go to the next paragraph.
I just wanted you to comment on his, when he's referring to part metal, part flesh, when robo-beings constitute the growing majority of a Western culture. What does he mean by robo-beings?
It's part robot, part metal, part flesh.
Yeah, but, you cited the fact that, you know, some people were getting, you know, pacemakers, but that doesn't constitute the growing majority of Western culture. He's referring to something else here.
Well, no, it's more than pacemakers by the 80s. All kinds of prosthetic technologies being embedded in people.
But these still don't constitute the growing majority of Western culture. These are a tiny minority of people who need these supplemental devices.
Right. Now, you're thinking in terms of the chemical body being replaced, but he's talking about the televised world of the 50s and 60s has now become part of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that he calls the news broadcasters android processors. The thing is, that's later in the 90s, but robo-beings is people engaging in mechanical and software technologies more intimately due to the digital digital seduction and ability of the chip landscape to be more and more invisible. And so people were embracing all kinds of technologies with less caution than they did in the McLuhan and pre-McLuhan era.
Yeah.
So his term for that is robo-being. Now, he's going to develop that.
Now, we're in the phase of the, this is pre-chip body, this is chip landscape. Is that
right? Yeah, we're describing the chip landscape.
Yeah. And
the TV body hasn't even shown up. We did TV with McLuhan and computers with Thompson. Now we're doing chip tech, chip landscape. So McLuhan was a TV landscape. Thompson was somewhere in between the TV landscape and the coming chip landscape via instant replay and those in-between technologies and the beginning of digitalization. But Croker is dealing with the later phase of the chip landscape. You get into the chip and TV body in the 90s.
Right. So would you say that existentialism is an extension, is a progression, is an evolution of nominalism and postmodern is a, nihilism is a, is an evolution of the existentialism?
No. Existentialism is not, it's post-literate. Nominalism is a literate
Gutenberg
category.
Right.
Existentialism is, in a way, might look nihilistic to the literate. The way Sartre lived was pretty bizarre for most literate citizens. So existentialism is post-literate. It's an early phase. It's the phase of hyper-modern, not quite post-modern. And then the nihilism of the post-modern world is not the chemical body adopting a post-literate sensibility. It's the environment becoming existentialist.
Mm.
So basically, Croker is showing us how the lack of traditional humanist values is now acted out by the technology. In a sense, it's coming alive, and it begins with existentialism.
Mm-hmm.
It's by its very nature going to be existential.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see if the next paragraph helps us say that.
Consequently, a deep, parentheses, panic, thematic, runs through the text. It explores the passive and suicidal nihilism of contemporary culture from shifting perspectives of popular culture.
And then he gives the title of that part of the book, Sunshine Reports.
Classicism.
Chapter titled Sign Crimes.
Mm-hmm. Post-structuralist philosophy.
Chapter titled Sliding Signifiers.
And art.
The title is Ultramodernism.
Whether viewing the postmodern scene from the perspective of its first theorist,
Augustine. Now that's St. Augustine, 420 A.D. or was it after the Common Era, A.C.E. or C.E. to use the new terms, 400 Common Era. Now how could Augustine be part of the postmodern scene? Well, we're going to see that, but that's a pretty extreme statement, saying that Augustine was the first postmodern, first theorist. What do you think of that?
That's pretty going to take some explaining.
Yeah. It's postmodern philosophical precursors.
Nietzsche and Bataille.
Bataille. Nietzsche died around, 1900? And Bataille was a surrealist thinker, writer in the 30s and 40s.
Hmm. It's artists,
Eric Fischel, Chirico, Magritte, and Francesca Woodman. She was a photographer in the 70s who committed suicide at the age of 24 or something.
Ouch. Or its key social theorists,
Baudrillard, Sayers, and Foucault.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so whether viewing the postmodern scene from the perspective of its first theorists, its philosophical precursors, its artists, or its key social theorists, and these are all the people that are going to be discussed in the book, it is the same thing.
Just speed it up a bit.
There's your speed point. Okay, carry on.
Thus, if the writing moves at hyperspeed to the point of trying to achieve escape velocity from the language of positivist sociology and conventional ideological discourse, that is because the postmodern scene also seeks to evoke a certain literary mood. Italicized here, it says panic reading as a way of participating directly in the ruins within and without of late 20th century experience.
So you can see the idea of everything disappeared is included in that last sentence, right?
Mm-hmm.
The ruins within and without. Now what's interesting, I'm just thinking that this is the ruins in communication spaces. This is the people still walking around, the chemical body's still walking around, but more and more they begin to look dumb and dumber, and it's all leading up to our present. You know, Croker does a book called The Panic Encyclopedia in the late 80s, which develops what we're seeing in the postmodern scene, in the book The Postmodern Scene. And he says the Panic Encyclopedia describes the present decade better than the 80s or the 90s. So we're going to even get even wackier, in the sense that you have a president in our decade who doesn't communicate. This is a reflection of developments in the 80s where the chemical bodies are walking around, but they have no common social space. They have no common media. You have what's called, you know, increasing fragmented or atomized lives of people in the West. And so the breakdown of media spaces is what we're talking about. So that we're walking around with ruins within and without of our mediated spaces, or what are to become memes.
Mm-hmm.
Memes being like the memory of them.
Mm-hmm.
So let's read the next paragraph.
I was thinking of, you know, back in Roman times when they had all the pantheon of gods.
Yeah.
You know, they had a coherent mythology that they lived within, you know,
a visual container.
Yeah, and so then now we get up to this period, and there's no overarching metaphor or mythology or container. Yeah.
Not even an acoustic space.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean. All cultures are wiped out because they're either based on speech-based. Either you have speech and no print, or speech and print. And then you have the industrial machines, but now they're wrecked and contained within the... They've been made discarnate.
Right.
They're just O's and ones on the Wall Street global computer hookup.
So what does that do to our story of ourselves, which is where we derive a sense of identity?
Right, so the story no longer becomes a normal narrative. It becomes fascination with catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
And reappearance. So let's read the next paragraph, and you'll see it's easy to understand in light of what we just said. So he's describing the book and what they're refusing.
Mm-hmm. Refusing, in parentheses here with Nietzsche, the pragmatic compromise which only seeks to preserve, the postmodern scene can recommend so enthusiastically panic reading because it seeks to relieve the gathering darkness by a new and more local cultural strategy. That is, to theorize, and that's italicized, with such hyper-intensity that the simulacrum is forced finally to implode into the dark density of its own detritus, and to write that's italicized, so faithfully under the schizoid signs of Nietzsche and Bataille that burnout, discharge, and waste as the characteristic qualities of the postmodern condition are compelled to reveal their lingering traces on the after images of, in parentheses, our bodies, politics, sexuality, and economy. Hypertheory, therefore, for the end of the world.
read the two paragraphs quickly. Just you see, it's the same themes we already been through, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to... I looked up the word detritus just for the hell of it. It says streets filled with rubble and debris, gravel, sand, silt, other materials produced by erosion, organic material produced by decomposition of organisms.
Yeah, so the chip landscape erodes the TV, radio, book, industrial landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
Turns them into dust. It's like a flood came through. It's like New Orleans.
Yeah.
After the present chip whirlpool, chip flood. Mm-hmm. So just reading through that again, he says, so he's describing what the book is trying to do. And he's not only doing panic writing, he's encouraging panic reading. It's like join in and consume as fast as possible before the something changes and you've been suicided.
Yeah, I still, you know, it seems like this is, see, when you go through the vanishing point, which happened when the electronic, you know, environment began, you know, I guess probably with telegraph or at least radio, you know, everything's speeding up as it goes through the vanishing point, and then everything disappears. And this is like coming out the vanishing point on the other side, where it's everything is really fast because it's coming out of the disappeared state or reappearing or something.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I say the medium for the Croker quadrant and for Croker is the movie. Thompson, it's the printed book. For McLuhan's electric media, for LaRouche, it's a newspaper. But the movie is a hyperkinetic medium or a kinetic extension. And definitely Croker surfaces after the golden age of movies in the 70s.
Right.
Now you've got special effects movies in the 80s. So it's virtual movie. So Croker is offering...
The movie is the fast sequence of frames which only create the illusion of being... of coherence. It's just one frame after another, but then there's an illusion of connectedness.
Well, that's if you take the specialist knowledge of analyzing perception and the brain chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about one skull, but the movie is an environment as the effect of creating reality. Remember McLuhan's pun, the real world, R-E-E-L.
Yeah.
So it may be just a sequence of flickering images, but people get very involved in it. It's real. It's engaging for the senses. It's an extension of the senses. But we were talking earlier about tactility. I think we said this. Tactility is immobility. But when people try to translate, or if you have too much tactility, it flips back into hyperkinetic space. The illusion of movement. So in that sense, you're relating the perceptual mechanism of movie as a metaphor for the 80s being an illusion. It's a hyper speed up, mm-hmm. if you think of it as a global movie, right?
Yeah.
But a digital special effects movie. So the tactility of the 1560s that McLuhan celebrated has been pushed to too much use. And McLuhan recommended, let's turn it off occasionally so we don't get into the situation. But because we didn't turn it off, we flipped into hyperkineticism, which is a kind of reappearance. So, yeah, we went through the vanishing point and then reappeared in a space provided by the chip landscape.
So it was probably in the 60s when McLuhan talked about, no art form could be an anti-environment anymore except that... the quote here from earlier in the book, when art fails to cope with the environment by being an anti-environment, then there can be a shift to a rapid succession of innovations as ersatz anti-environments. I'm wondering if there's any correlation between this rapid succession of innovations as ersatz anti-environments and this idea of the movie being, you know, rapid movement of imagery we were just talking about, or if that goes beyond what Marshall was talking about. Or
okay, well, that's interesting. McLuhan said the movie contained all media. So all media become the content for this virtual quantum chip landscape. And And so all the media are in hyperaction, hyper attempts to reappear their own purpose or sense of engagement with their human content. That becomes in a state of panic. That's what you're pointing to, is the rapid succession of innovations
creates a kind of a storyline in a way. You know, it creates, you know, that's the container we live inside of.
Right. Now, that was the conditions under McLuhan. When you get to the chip landscape, it's like the chip landscape or the Android meme needs this rapid series of innovations to keep its own sense going. So it's no longer providing an anti-environment to humans. It's trying to keep itself going. And so Croker wants to jump into that and mime it. And so, yes, Croker engaged in any medium he could use. He made CDs, did radio shows, did performance pieces, wrote books, made little movies, videos. You just wallow around in the excess and mime the panic of the chip landscape, which itself is trying to get a form of anti-environment with a rapid series. And the general effect of that is like, yeah, a movie, but it's a virtual movie. And a movie contains all media, so you're into a virtual, post-tactile
sense of
movement.
When Marshall talked about the medium as the message or the massage, well, when Croker communicates through book or through CD or through short films or what, it's this, he's communicating the same message. I think he's saying that the medium no longer each have their own massage. It's the same message he's giving you through everything, which is panic. He said, you know, notice that it's all just freaking out. There's no other message here.
That's right. And what he says that McLuhan's idea of the medium as a message or media being extensions of us failed to deal with the 80s, because in the 80s, the extensions of us no longer are massaging us. They now turn on us and eat us as it extends itself. It rips us apart.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, you said the lacerated body.
Yeah. And what's the symptoms that we see in, you know,
what would be the symptoms of that phenomenon?
Yeah, you know, in terms of chemical body world.
Excess, disaccumulation, and waste.
Yeah. And where do we see that? I mean, what forms in terms of medicine or manufacturing or...
Well, there's a lot of examples of that today. The average citizen understands, they've now projected a global warming. We're all going to be heated away in 20 years.
Right.
But if you go back to the 80s, I don't know what you were aware of then, but there were a lot of inklings of the same catastrophic thinking people have in this decade back in the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, there was pollution. Greenpeace was running amok trying to stop things. Didn't work. Everything just got...
Save the whales.
Yeah, remember Live Aid. Just think of the starvation in Africa. Just think of all the AIDS.
Right.
Think of AIDS. Devastation in the 80s. In so many areas. That was many American farmers committing suicide because the agricultural economy collapsed in the early 80s under the high interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of disaster going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, that's the area, that's the mood and news stories that Croker is playing off of.
Yeah.
There was a lot of catastrophe in so many institutions in the 80s.
Or the drug of choice in the 80s was cocaine?
Yeah. That's that Zappa's Cocaine Decision song. It makes fun of that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once he was interviewed on CNN or something, and she was asking, well, where are all these people doing the cocaine? And he points to off the studio to the camera and says, look at them, they're doing cocaine. Everybody in the studio is doing cocaine just off the camera there.
Yeah.
Metaphor, they weren't actually doing it while they're on the job, but, you know, they were doing it when they went home with their paychecks.
Yeah.
A lot of people, you know, blasted their noses, got in trouble. It was all kind. I mean, what, that's when they had silicon implants.
Yeah.
All those problems that surfaced in the 90s based on what the women did in the 80s with their bodies.
Yeah. And so rather than just being a kind of a trend, you know, monkey see, monkey do, you're saying that this was that people wanted to do this because it was they were the way that the media landscape was tearing us apart was...
Yeah, it made everybody become panic and either a passive or a suicidal nihilist. A passive nihilist is someone who just was a consumer. A suicidal nihilist was a Wall Street businessman.
Yeah. Wasn't the 80s referred to as the me generation?
No, that was the 70s.
Oh, the 70s.
The 80s, if there was a cliche, a guy wrote a journal, an article for Esquire or something, and he called it the rerun decade.
Hmm.
Now, that's a really good phrase, because if you think of the Android meme replaying the history of technology, he didn't mean it that way, but that's what I say it is, and that's the right term.
Was it already doing that by the 80s?
The 80s was the golden days of the Android meme, because the Android meme becomes an afterimage in the 90s.
Oh, and this is before the bodies are... The landscape, chip body landscape.
And no, we read that quote. The after images, the Coker has, the after images of our bodies, politics, sexuality, and economy.
Mm-hmm.
But the 90s is the after image of what was making the body and politics, sexuality, and economy an after image. The Android meme.
Mm-hmm.
So the Android meme's a figure in the 80s, eating everything up, causing everybody else to eat everything up, and then vomit it out, bulimia and anorexia, and then the... after image of the Android meme is the 90s.
Yeah, so I just want to emphasize this and see if you agree, because this is kind of what I'm getting here, is that, you know, when Marshall talked about the media is the massage, you know, he's talking about media as being hot and cool. Each media had its own way of its own massage on the collective, and then when we put media together and we got like a mixed corporate media, there was like a mixed corporate massage of these different media types. But now it looks like each media no longer has its own massage. They're all, each media is having the same effect, and it's not you can't divide radio and books and so on into hot and cool and having their own peculiar effect.
Yeah, the media spaces that previous media environments created are now superseded by a seamless web caused by the chip landscape where there's no division between the media, and you can almost say there's no media. There's just one space. What McLuhan intuited when he said the word makes the market. The Android meme is the word, but it's a virtual word that's talking to itself and not to the humans. The previous phase were media spaces that were engaging the human body, extending it. Now the chip landscape is just extending itself and eating up anything caught in its crossfire.
Yeah, so I remember that, AIDS was the big deal, the Live Aid thing, and everybody was ripping everybody off. Rumors George Bush was ransacking the savings and loans and all kinds of stuff like that going on. So, yeah, I kind of remember that.
Yeah, a lot of catastrophe in the 80s. Iran-Contra. Even the great Reagan administration imploded on itself in terms of its image with Iran-Contra.
Mm-hmm.
Ravaging of the body and the body politic.
And Reagan... Was that when he was saying, I don't remember, or was that in the 90s?
No, that's the late 80s.
Yeah, his memory started failing, so...
He became the postmodern scene, too.
Yeah.
He was celebrating amnesia.
Yeah.
So, now, take those themes that we've been discussing, and I'm going to reread the last two paragraphs of this first quote that we've been doing in the Coker section, and see how the language... resonates with the effects we've been just talking about. Okay, Coker says, consequently, a deep panic thematic runs through the text, his own book. But that's because that's what's happening in the world. It explores the passive and suicidal nihilism of contemporary culture from the shifting perspectives of popular culture, classicism, post-structuralist philosophy, and art. And he has the chapter title in brackets, which we went through before. Then he says, whether viewing the postmodern scene from the perspective of its first theorist, Augustine, its philosophical precursors, Nietzsche and Bataille, its artists, Fischel, Chirico, Magritte, and Woodman, or its key social theorists, Baudrillard, Serres, and Foucault, it is the same thing. Just speed it up a bit. Thus, if the writing moves at hyperspeed to the point of trying to achieve escape velocity from the language of positivist sociology and conventional ideological discourse. That is because the postmodern scene also seeks to evoke a certain literary mood, panic reading, as a way of participating directly in the ruins within and without of late 20th century experience. So he's trying to get you in the panic mood through a style of writing so you can experience the panic ground all around you.
Mm-hmm.
Refusing, with Nietzsche, the pragmatic compromise, which only seeks to preserve. Now, that's the like the search for lost coherencies, or you're still talking to somebody who's going to, in a social space, you're going to share the space, and therefore you're going to make some compromises and practicalities of existence. That's not necessary in the time of the digital landscape. You don't need to make a pragmatic compromise which seeks to preserve some tradition. So the book, The Postmodern Scene, refuses the pragmatic compromise, which only seeks to preserve. Kroger's not trying to preserve anything, because the postmodern scene can recommend so enthusiastically panic reading, because it seeks to relieve the gathering darkness by a new and more local cultural strategy. So he's suggesting some kind of local strategy. That is, to theorize with such hyper-intensity and that the simulacrum is forced finally to implode into the dark density of its own detritus, and to write so faithfully under the schizoid signs of Nietzsche and Bataille that burnout, discharge, and waste, as the characteristic qualities of the postmodern condition, are compelled to reveal their lingering traces on the afterimages of our bodies, politics, sexuality, and economy. Hyper-theory, therefore, for the end of the world. He's not even, like, trying to make a stable theory.
Mm-hmm.
He's just going to create what McLuhan predicted, hyper-pattern recognition.
Mm-hmm.
For the end of the world, and that's a given. It is the end of the world. It's what is his ground. We are in the end of the world in the 80s.
And when that becomes, concresses into the idea of the apocalypse, which a lot of people accuse the neo-conservatives of, believing that, in the biblical end times.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of rise of fundamentalism in the 80s.
Oh, there was?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the televangelists was, the 80s was their big decade, and then there was the fundamentalism in the Middle East.
Who was president during this time? Would that have been Carter?
No, Reagan.
Oh, Reagan, yeah. Oh, yeah.
This is Tammy Baker and Jimmy Swaggart time.
Reagan wasn't really fundamentalist in the same sense.
No, but he courted the moral majority.
Mm.
That's Zappa writes about how he was told in 79 that the Republican Party was going to team up with the growing moral majority of the late 70s and sweep to power, and that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what Zappa fought. That, quote, conspiracy,
yeah.
That alignment. But basically the White House realized that there was a certain panic state going on out there in the basic populist level of America. Everybody already was regarding it the end of the world.
Yeah.
And the televangelist apocalyptic style of preaching became very popular in the Reagan era.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's another thing. You have an academic responding for that. Kroker, as an academic, is making fun of the end-of-the-world popular attitude that was happening in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to reread that paragraph again, just smoother. Refusing with Nietzsche the pragmatic compromise which only seeks to preserve, the postmodern scene can recommend so enthusiastically panic reading because it seeks to relieve the gathering darkness by a new and more local cultural strategy. Like a chemical body strategy, okay? We're going to, or maybe at the beginning of the TV body, we're going to target locally. That would be the simulacrum. That is, to theorize with such hyper-intensity that the simulacrum is forced finally to implode into the dark density of its own detritus, and to write so faithfully under the schizoid signs. He's admitting that he's going to be schizoid, contradictory. And to write so faithfully under the schizoid signs of Nietzsche and Bataille, that burnout, discharge, and waste as the characteristic qualities of the postmodern condition are compelled to reveal the lingering traces on the afterimages of our bodies, politics, sexuality, and economy. Hyper-theory, therefore, for the end of the world. In other words, hyper-theory, therefore, for the rise of fundamentalism in so many aspects across the globe.
Mm-hmm.
Remember in that period you went to work and you had to have your urine measured for drugs. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
That's the panic surveillance.
Mm-hmm. Now, the simulacrum, does he start using that term congruent with the seamless web of
yes.
media?
That's Baudrillard. He gets that from Baudrillard.
Mm.
Now, Baudrillard discusses, you brought up the lack of media spaces. That's what Baudrillard writes in the late 70s. He says McLuhan was right that the meaning was a message, but those spaces aren't there anymore. So Baudrillard really makes the next breakthrough on McLuhanism. And McLuhan intuited this, but he didn't get to write it. So Baudrillard got the ball, carried it, and then Croker studied McLuhan and Baudrillard, so then he picked up on it, and he went further than Baudrillard. Which Baudrillard would have promoted, because that was the postmodern strategy. That was the local cultural strategy.
You know,
take the hyperintensity of the simulacrum and ram it up its ass.
Well, we've always been programmed by culture, hypnotized by our cultural, by the environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, tightly coupled with it, it programs us, we program it. So what we've called it before it was a simulacrum?
They called it the media.
Oh, okay.
That was the phrase that McLuhan popularized. So in the 1670s, people said, well, the media does this, the media did that. And what did they mean by the media? I think they meant the news. But the news was the word that makes the market that represented the seamless web. So it was an early phase of the Android meme, the phrase media.
Mm-hmm.
And then a later term for the Android meme is the simulacrum.
Yeah, when it becomes seamless.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the 60s, people are talking about the media as something else, something over there, kind of interfering with